Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. In this hour, an update on medical cannabis, Lexington as an agriculture technology hub, and the notion of a new public university for Southeast Kentucky. First, with only a few exceptions, the Kentucky General Assembly has for the past couple of decades cut the state's contribution to higher education. The results of this are detailed in a report from the Kentucky Center for Economic Policy and United Campus Workers of Kentucky, and it's titled, When Higher Ed is a Lower Priority, Kentucky Campus Workers Sound the Alarm. Here to talk about it are Dustin Pugel from the Center for Economic Policy. Welcome, Dustin.
Hey, Tom.
And Elise Franklin, who teaches history at the University of Louisville and is a member of the Campus Workers Union. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Elise.
Thanks very much.
So, Dustin, let's begin with you, if we could. If you would, give us just a little bit of a nutshell history of this decline in higher ed funding, if that's possible.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think you said it really well. For the last couple of decades, the state's investment in higher education has been slipping. If we look at 2008, which is a year we often benchmark to, you know, kind of the beginning of the Great Recession when a lot of state cuts happened, state funding for higher education has dropped by almost 33%. So that's really significant. And what it's led to is not only higher tuition, which puts a lot of strain on students, but also a lot of really difficult choices for school administrators that lead to shifting that cost over to staff as well, staff and faculty. So that means larger classroom sizes. That means fewer tenured faculty who can be there long term. It means fewer support services, which means that faculty end up picking up a lot of the jobs that say counselors might be doing typically. And Elise can detail that a lot more. But ultimately, what we've ended up with is sort of an austerity budget for higher education in Kentucky. And the one area that we're seeing a small uptick is something called a performance fund, which is a smaller pot of money that universities and colleges have to compete for based off of certain metrics. And while, you know, any increase in funding is a good thing, even that pot of money has created inequities. So Morehead State University and Kentucky State University, for example, haven't gotten any of that money over the last couple of years. So it's creating further inequities between schools and forcing universities who serve students who need it the most to deal with that with the least amount of money.
Elise, what are the main concerns being raised by non-tenure employees? Is pay, health insurance, both?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked this question. So I was surveyed, and the things that I spoke to, I'm a tenure track professor, which means that I'm in line to go up for tenure, and I theoretically could have that job protection, but I don't yet. So a lot of the things that people in my position feel is like the pressure of underpay and overwork. And this usually means things like routine requests to increase our class sizes. And now that might not sound like a lot in one class, but when that happens again and again across sections, when we teach three or four per semester, that's a lot of students. And that adds up to a lot of not just in-class or grading time, but it adds up to a lot of student face-to-face time. And what I've found, and my colleagues have seen as well, is that students need more support and not less, especially since COVID. And as a result, I'm spending more and more time in that one-on-one problem-solving mode when I have less time to actually do that now, paradoxically. So that's one way we feel the pressure. Another is just a case of salary stagnation. Professors, staff, we're paid below benchmark at U of L, and that's something that many of us have tried to raise, but it's impossible to do without reinvestment from the state.
In some parts of the country, the ratio of adjunct professors to tenured faculty has reached as high as 75% adjunct. What proportion of Kentucky higher ed instructors are adjunct or contingent faculty?
We still have a majority of faculty in Kentucky who are tenured or tenure track. So it's about a 4 out of 5 that are either tenure or tenure track, and 1 out of 5 who are either adjunct or instructors or some other type of instructional staff but are non-tenured. The problem, though, is that the trend is moving in the wrong direction. So if we look at the trend since 2002, what we see is that tenure track positions have fallen by almost 10%, but non-tenured positions have increased by a quarter. So, you know, we're still not in a terrible position in the state, but if things keep going the way they're going, it could get that way very quickly.
I'd just like to add as well that I completely support like what the numbers say, but on the ground, it also feels a little bit different in terms of where students meet tenured or tenure track professors, because it's usually in the introductory courses that students have a part-time faculty teaching them. And those are the place where the students actually need the most support from the instructor. And since part-time faculty aren't given the same supports from the administration, sometimes they don't even have necessarily office space with which to meet with students, it's a lot harder to meet those introductory students where they are. And that's, you know, really crucial, is getting them from their first semester freshman year into their second, and then certainly over the summer into their third.
It's a good moment to talk about tenure. What do you say when people in other lines of work in the private sector say they don't enjoy tenure, so why should university professors have that kind of protection?
Yeah, I'd say that the crucial takeaway here is that when there's high staff and faculty turnover at universities, students suffer. So since I started at U of L nearly 5 years ago, my department's lost 4 full-time faculty and a staff person. And because of the disinvestment, we haven't been able to hire for these positions again. That means that we're all doing more with less, teaching more classes, taking on more administrative work. And that hurts morale, and it causes more people to leave. And what we're seeing is that our students suffer when there's high turnover and little continuity. And so when we don't have these tenure track or tenured professors, students don't have the benefit of building a relationship that's long term and which is supportive and helps to bring them through their course to degree.
What's been happening with things like health benefits?
I'll just say that both health benefits and pension plans have been decreasing over time. So one thing that we see in the data, but also that we heard over and over again from respondents in the survey, is that this shift in costs to faculty and staff is usually incurred through higher contributions for healthcare, higher contributions for retirement. I actually saw a lot about parking. So a lot of faculty and staff have to pay for their own daily parking at their own place of work. So all of these benefits that folks saw years ago are starting to slip away. I mean, another example is that, at the University of Kentucky, there used to be a steeply discounted use of healthcare there at the university hospital. And now folks are having to pay more and more for that. So there's just a continued shift away from benefits, generous benefits for public university staff and faculty. At the same time, pay is stagnating. So they're asking faculty and staff to pay more with a shrinking salary. And that's really difficult to do.
Well, peeling back the layers of the onion here, we stated earlier in our conversation that the state legislature has not provided adequate funding over many years. What drives that? Why is that? Why is that the case? Why isn't higher education a primary investment in this state?
You know, it's hard to say. That usually in budget conversations, there's not a direct conversation about deprioritizing anything. I know during the Great Recession, there were cuts across the board to try and deal with what we were all dealing with at the time. The real question for me is, now that we are in the boom years, essentially, when we have $1 billion annual surplus, we have $3.7 billion in a rainy day fund, why we're not reinvesting now? It's like we're austerity budgeting in the boom years, and that just doesn't make any sense. Instead, we're asking students and faculty and staff to pick up what the state has not been investing. So, you know, it's not really clear to me why that's not happening, but it is clear to me that we have the money to do it now if we so choose.
You mentioned staffing. Has staffing been on the decline? And what does that mean, not just to faculty, but also to students?
Staffing has certainly been on the decline. To take just the case of my department, the Department of History, we used to have two full-time support staff who helped to run the department. And now, since I've been there, we only have one. So that's a huge change, even though it seems like small numbers. But on the whole, this really affects students negatively. When we look at things like advising or student success centers, that support means everything to helping especially first-year and second-year students get through the transition from high school to college. And we know that when we have early interventions, and especially with students who maybe are somewhere at the, you know, D or C grade level, if they have intervention, that helps them to stay in school and has a really positive impact on their outcomes. But when there aren't enough staff to reach out to those students, ones who really need help, as well as ones who are on the bubble, those students all suffer. It also means that when there aren't that robust staff to support students, that falls on other realms, for example, on faculty or on other students. And that support is important, but it's not their training, right? So this we're missing an entire expertise as well.
You earlier described conditions that certainly would lead to burnout. And I'm just wondering, your report looks at faculty and staff burnout. You describe a higher ed workforce with many at a breaking point. What does that mean?
The bottom line is that 7 in 10 of the respondents to our survey said that they've considered leaving their job in the last year for reasons other than retiring. And when you look at the types of comments that they left, that's no surprise. I mean, a large number of them said that they've been having to go out and recruit students themselves. They've been having to fill out a lot of paperwork that normally administrative staff would do, but they don't have administrative staff. 3 out of 4 of them have said that their departments are shrinking or they haven't gotten any better. And 2/3 of them say that they're already too small. So, you know, what a breaking point really looks like, an exodus of employees at our higher education institutions. And at that point, you know, we really can't continue to function as a higher ed system the way we would like to and the way that it should.
You have some thoughts on that, too, Elise?
I do. I think that at a baseline, investing in staff and faculty is investing in students. And when you have fewer support staff, when you have fewer instructors, that means that each semester we're feeling the additional pressure of those absent people. Larger class sizes, for example, means less individual instruction. So we're all working hard within the university to do what we can with the tools that we have. And the trouble is that we're doing it without adequate compensation, we're doing it on our own time and without the necessary support. And as you said, that's the exact recipe for burnout. I haven't spoken to a faculty member in the past 3 years who hasn't mentioned burnout.
Well, why should the Kentucky business community be paying close attention to these concerns?
One thing that I'd like to raise, and which I think doesn't get considered enough, is that our goal at U of L and in higher ed across the country is to keep students in school in order to obtain their degree. And what we're seeing, especially as students take on more and more of the burden of paying for the operating cost of the university as their tuitions go up, it means that students are always doing that cost-benefit analysis. Am I getting enough out of my degree? And without enough input and investment in the university, we're seeing that students are beginning to rethink this. The trouble is that students that end up leaving with debt and without a degree, they leave without the thing they came for, and they go away with an added thing, which is that debt. That's bad for Kentucky. It's bad for Kentuckians, and it's really bad for our students who deserve to have a debt-free future.
Yeah, I'll just add that, you know, colleges and universities are really, really important to the communities in which they're situated. I mean, everything Elise said is true. Folks who earn a college degree are better off on a whole host of measures, including social measures, health benefits, financial benefits, obviously. But also businesses located in communities where universities are situated typically have more innovation. They have a higher educated workforce available to them. There's evidence even that for every 1% increase in university spending on low-income students, there's a 2.4% increase in local incomes. So I really think of universities not only as places of learning, which they are primarily, but they're also economic engines for the communities in which they're located. So I think if the business community really cares about making Kentucky a more prosperous place, a more competitive place, and a place where people really want to move to and stay in, then they really should think of investments in higher education as investments in their own well-being.
All right. That's Dustin Pugel from the Center for Economic Policy. Thank you so much, Dustin.
It's great to be with you.
And Elise Franklin, who teaches history at the University of Louisville and is a member of the Campus Workers Union. Thanks, Elise.
Thanks so much for having me.
Last year, the Kentucky General Assembly called on the Council on Postsecondary Education to look into the pros and cons of building a new four-year public university in southeastern Kentucky. The council was to study three options: establishing a new residential public university, acquiring a private university, or establishing a residential campus as a satellite of an existing regional public university like Eastern or Moorhead. The council did the study and found that each of the three options is in some way problematic. The call for the study came from an Eastern Kentuckian, Senate President Robert Stivers. Senator Stivers, what was the vision or the intent behind the General Assembly's joint resolution that called on the Council on Postsecondary Education to look into the feasibility of establishing a public residential four-year university in southeast Kentucky?
Well, if you have read all the report or had conversations with individuals from the region and the CPE, that area is defined as an higher ed desert. So that's one. Two, the impact of the coal industry losing favor with various federal administrations on energy production, which cost a lot of jobs in the area, direct and indirect jobs. The realities, number three, of it being an area that has a high poverty rate and low educational attainment levels, which I think can be directly related back to number one. So those three things, economics, education, access to education, attainment levels, were all part of the calculus in asking for a study and a look at developing something in that region.
Well, the Council on Postsecondary Education did that, and they've come back with their report, and it concludes that building a new university would be, as they put it, prohibitively expensive, and its long-term viability uncertain. Does that finding take the concept off the table for you, or are you continuing to think about it and encourage that it be further explored?
I think that was a conclusion, and it wasn't unexpected, but they had some other alternatives. And I think there is a possibility of looking at some of those alternatives and blending them together. I don't think it's off the table.
One of those options that the CPE identified was perhaps involving Hazard Community and Technical College, making HCTC a standalone college or university that would offer both sub-baccalaureate technical programs and a few bachelor's programs that would be in line with the area's workforce demand. And I'm just wondering, as one who has served in the Kentucky State Senate for, what are we going on, 27 years now, and now as its president, does that seem feasible? Do you think the legislature would get behind that idea?
I'll go back to your previous question, you know, to build from scratch a four-year residential university, as I said, was, you know, their finding that it would not be feasible. That's why I said it's not unexpected. To modify something like the Hazard KCTCS campus probably is more pragmatic. So that is something, and I do agree with the CPE that it is something that should look at more of a traditional baccalaureate postgraduate scenario, but with a heavy emphasis in vocational, technical, job skills, and certifications, because I think that's better suited to the area. So a hybrid model, but still looking at that job creation, job development, economics, and educational attainment levels is still part of the mission and goal.
Do you think the region, all of us in the region, are kind of caught in this chicken and egg situation? That is, without enough population to support a four-year university, there's no university to retain and attract population. Seems to kind of be cyclical there.
You know, that's where you have to make the decision. And I think there's, that is one alternative, a good alternative, but there are, I shouldn't really say alternative. I think that is maybe one arrow in a quiver of many that could be used, but not exclusive, to create better job opportunities and better retention and attraction, because there's two components. One, you want to retain what you have, and you want to attract some new, or as much new as possible. So there's a couple other things that I think have to fit into that puzzle to make it all work, but I think that would be a really good piece of the puzzle.
And in the end, this is all about economic development. You need that university to, as a generator of the kind of talent and skill and know-how that supports the growth of industry, correct?
Growth of industry, you know, job retention, job development. Let's throw another layer on that, quality of life. That's, you generally seem to see a different type of socioeconomic strata in and around colleges, universities, college towns, and university towns.
Well, what does this mean to you, Senator Stivers, personally, as somebody who lives in Clay County in Manchester, to you and your neighbors, if there were to be this kind of an institution close by?
Well, let me give you a personal story. Even though my parents and grandparents and in-laws and individuals, grandparents of my children, were able to make sure things were done for their children and grandchildren, there's a lot who can't afford to do what my daughters did in going other places in this state to attain their degrees. So when I would look at Western Kentucky University and where my daughter was attending, you know, and the programs they had, it was like, wow, why don't we have something like this in Eastern Kentucky? And that would make a lot of difference to a lot of students. Yes, I made sure my daughter could go to Western, attend and take those programs, but that was a 3.5-hour drive. That's tough on a lot of people. So from that perspective, accessibility to higher ed and financial accessibility becomes a key component, and having something in close proximity can make a huge difference in both of those.
Where are you now on this effort to bring higher ed closer to home for people in Southeast Kentucky? Is it something that might come up in the next session, or is it off a bit?
No, I think the discussion will take place. I think there, there's 3-4 Senate members in and around that area. You know, that discussion is going to take place. I think understanding modeling, it may be more of a feasibility study to look at costing and benefits, or as most people would say, a cost-benefit analysis. But that discussion will continue to move forward in this legislative process.
All right. That's Senate President and Clay Countian, Robert Stiversen. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The legislature had further orders for the Council on Postsecondary Education. Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley has written about it. Thanks for joining us, McKenna.
Thanks for having me.
The legislature gave the council a second mission, and that was to come up with an assessment of Kentucky's higher education system now that more than 2 decades have gone by since the passage of the Kentucky Postsecondary Education Improvement Act of 1997. The goal was more Kentuckians with degrees, resulting in a higher standard of living for Kentuckians. What did the council have to say about Kentucky's college-going rate?
The study found that over the last 25 years, the state's public education system has made substantial progress, but some trends are there that if they remain unchecked, they will place future educational attainment gains at risk. For example, Kentucky still lags the nation in its college-going rate. Since 2000, we have seen some improvement in educational attainment, and Kentucky does have one of the best in the nation, but there is a decline in enrollment, especially among minority students, and graduation rates are approaching the national average.
Well, what did the council report say about funding higher ed before and after the Postsecondary Education Improvement Act of 97?
Before higher education reform, general fund appropriations from the state made up 2/3 of funding for post-secondary education, while the remaining third came from tuition and fee revenue. Now those shares are reversed.
The legislature also asked CPE to study the feasibility of splitting the Kentucky Community and Technical College system by transferring responsibility for traditional academic subjects to the regional universities, while leaving technical education with KCTCS. What did the council conclude about that?
CPE identified numerous drawbacks to this plan. It would be forcing 2-year college students to begin at 4-year university, which would lead to more costs for them and potentially deter them from enrolling in college altogether. Also, technical students would lose pathways to academic and transfer programs, and comprehensive universities would be unable to offer academic programs as affordably as community and technical colleges. CPE did say that a more comprehensive evaluation and more stakeholder engagement should be reviewed when reviewing these plans as well.
So what happens next?
Well, lawmakers return to Frankfort in January for their next legislative session. They'll likely review this report and debate their next move, especially because the resolution for the study was backed by a member of Senate leadership, which gives this much more significance. When he introduced it, Stivers did say this study was about exploring the state of Kentucky's public higher education since major reform happened to the system more than 25 years ago. And the educational landscape has significantly changed, especially in terms of remote and online learning.
Well, it's really interesting. This is going to be interesting to follow, isn't it?
Yes.
All right, that's Kentucky Lantern reporter McKenna Horsley, and you can find her article and other professional journalism about life and times in Kentucky online at KentuckyLantern.com. Thanks a lot, McKenna.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up after the break, making Lexington a go-to for agricultural technology innovation, and
we don't break laws, we change them.
Tweaking the state's new medical cannabis law. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
WEKU is supported by Berea College. With a commitment to serving Appalachian students, Berea has not charged tuition since 1892. All students participate in a paid work program, providing professional experience as well as an inclusive, supportive education. Details at berea.edu.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Lead Center for the Arts in Winchester will host a four-day stage combat intensive class January 11th through the 14th. Participants will learn the basic movements, attacks, and defenses of onstage swordplay. For information and to register, visit leadscenter.org. The Black and Lit Book Club, hosted by Lexington's Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, will discuss the novel Homeward by Angela Jackson Brown, 6 to 7 p.m., January 8th on Zoom. The event is free, but registration is required. For more information, visit carnegiecenterlex.org. And save the date, January 10th, to visit the state capitol in Frankfort for Arts Day in Kentucky. This special celebration is being presented by Kentuckians for the Arts. For more information on this event, visit kfta.wildapricot.org. I'm Sherry Lawson, now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Lexington, as a go-to hub of innovation in the field of agricultural technology. That's been a vision, and now it's closer to reality. Bob Helton has decades of experience in business management and economic development. In fact, he's a former chair of the Kentucky Association of Economic Developers. And now he is drawing on those experiences as he begins work as executive director of Bluegrass AgTech Development Corporation, a new partnership between the City of Lexington, the State Department of Agriculture, the University of Kentucky College of Agriculture, Food, and Environment, and Alltech. And the aim is to cultivate innovation and startups in the agricultural sector here in Lexington and Central Kentucky, statewide for that matter. Bob, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Well, I appreciate it, Tom. Glad to be here and appreciate talking with you.
I know this was a vision of Alltech founder, the late Dr. Pierce Lyons, now shared by his son, Mark, who has succeeded his father in the company's leadership, as well as Linda Gorton, well before she became mayor of Lexington. In fact, years ago, I ran into her at one of Alltech's annual international symposiums, and we were hanging out in the hallway talking about how Lexington and Kentucky have these deep agrarian roots and a lot of the assets that it would take to become a major hub for high-tech innovation in agriculture. And that what was needed was coordination and encouragement. Is it fair to say that that's what Bluegrass AgTech Development is all about?
Absolutely. And I know Dr. Mark Lyons takes a great deal of pride. You can see the pride in his eyes when he talks about his father's conversations with his father, 7, 8 years ago on this topic. And then at our launch event that we had a few weeks ago, it was surprising that the mayor pulled out notes from a few years back when she was, I guess, still on council and running for the mayor's seat. And in her notes, this concept was a bullet point even as she was running for mayor. So many years, and now with collaboration with Commissioner Quarles and the University of Kentucky folks bringing it to fruition. So it's been a very long conversation. And then I guess to add to that, a couple of years of planning, intense planning, when Ms. Shellman was brought on board as a consultant to lay out a roadmap for developing this. And there was a very good roadmap developed through that organization, a path very clear for this group to follow now.
Well, I mentioned that we have a lot of assets, and I'm wondering what in the way of the essential building blocks of an ag tech sector would you say that we have on hand right now today?
Well, today, certainly we have one of the foremost research and study universities in the country and the world, in the University of Kentucky. And then we, below that, we have a very strong network of regional universities, all deeply engaged in agriculture. On top of that, just our the natural geography of Kentucky, where we have different regions of the state. You know, the far west and the flatlands are very are used for large farming and some very large farm operations out there. Central Kentucky with our equine and other crops, and then East Kentucky has a whole different, in the mountainous region, a whole different type of agricultural needs. Particularly, one of our points is redeveloping ag in the middle, which would be the small to medium-sized farmers. So that's a segment that we really want to work closely with, too. On top of that, we have a very strong network of ag suppliers and ag vendors deeply engaged in the technology side. So, and all of that lays on top of our natural logistics in Kentucky of being a center point in the United States. So just lots of assets for the state.
Well, back in mid-November, you rolled out a challenge grant program. Let's talk about that. First of all, who would be eligible to receive one of these grants, and how large are they?
Well, what we have, and this is thanks to the State Ag Development Board, who granted $1 million for this program over 2 years, in addition to part of the City of Lexington's $500,000 grant for the ag program, in addition to their money that they've supplied for the operations of this unit. But so we in essence, over a 2 year period, have $1.5 million to make available for young entrepreneurs, and I use the word young in business, not in age, but folks in the startup mode that have a technology that can work with an agricultural application, and all going toward an economic development aim of building their business in Kentucky, if you will. So it's in the terminology of ag tech is a pretty broad term that we're working on focusing the absolute definition of ag tech, but an ag tech technology that is willing to place their business in Kentucky.
Requirement is that applicants address one of five focus areas. Let's talk about those. What are those focus areas?
Just a little earlier, I think I mentioned the concept of ag for the middle. So we're looking to find technologies and processes of either ag production or food production that will allow the small farm or the small operator to scale their business to be productive. And if you go back, think about the small farms, particularly in East Kentucky years ago, that had tobacco farms that were weekend farmers, that now that property's maybe still in the family, but not being used as much for agricultural as it was then. So redeveloping that concept, a resilient regional food system. And part of that came from the concept of supply chains that we experienced through the pandemic, that you know, maybe we were relying on someone in California or even overseas for some of our product, or even agricultural products such as fertilizer or other things needed. So looking at regionalizing that our supply chain is closer to home. And we've all been talking about food as health and how we can better our diets so that we're thinking deeper about healthy food, healthy, safe food, and local as well. Another concept is our protein, and we want to think about future-proofing meat and how we can give a solid foundation to our protein production, our beef and dairy operations. And the fifth one is kind of a catch-all for what we call Kentucky traditions. And that would, of course, be bourbon, beef, you know, all things that we do in Kentucky now that we're known for, poultry, Kentucky tradition kind of thing. So that's the five.
Are these applicants required to match grant funding?
Yes, there's a one-to-one match.
Okay. Are hemp and cannabis production on your radar?
It's hard not to be on our radar. I would say that there will be hemp more so in looking for products that can be grown and produced from hemp. As we all know, a couple of years ago, we had a strong run in the state thinking that hemp was going to be a very strong product, and unfortunately, the markets weren't developed to the point to take the production. But there are still lots of folks talking about hemp-derived products. So I think I would expect to see applicants utilizing hemp. Cannabis, I think, is one from a legal standpoint, but otherwise down the road still a bit for us.
Is the recent collapse of App Harvest something of an elephant in the room? Did that create any headwinds that you're aware of for the appetite for investment in these kinds of startup ventures?
I would like to think so. And, you know, full transparency, I was involved with App Harvest and setting up the first one in Moorhead, and then actually was an employee of the company for a while and was keenly disappointed in the direction that company went. But I'm still very bullish on that concept. And just by some of the personalities of that company, there was a lot of buzz and a lot of publicity. And I think a lot of that was very good. And I think going into the future, that still provides a catalyst for thinking along the lines that we're talking.
I know that you, Bob, you grew up on a farm in eastern Kentucky. How does that background inform what you'll be doing to develop an agriculture technology sector in the region?
Well, and, you know, certainly the ag in the middle fits very, very prominently as a freshman and even before going into high school, growing up on a small cattle farm in East Kentucky and raising our hay and corn and a herd of Hereford cattle provided a really good income for a young man at that point in the game, and a father who had a full-time job working away. And so a part-time operation, the ag in the middle, certainly plays. But looking at farm equipment and thinking about the farm equipment that I had in the mid and late 60s compared to things that are out there today, you know, we see farm tractors that are operated with GPS. We see drones operating for spraying crops that you actually operate from inside your home, and remembering how labor intensive some of the operations we had, and now applying the technologies that are available, not just agricultural but worldwide, but putting these technologies in an ag production position, just, you know, many times over improves the capacity and the production capabilities of farmers.
Well, this is going to be really interesting to follow, and I'd like to check in with you from time to time to see how things are going.
Well, I appreciate that. Look forward to talking more about it. And I know we're getting a good deal of very initial interest on our grant program, and I'm very optimistic that has the potential to develop into a very long-range program. So it's going to be fun to watch. I agree with you.
All right. That's Bob Helton, Executive Director of the new Bluegrass AgTech Development Corporation. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Tom.
So what exactly do we mean when we talk about agricultural technology? WEKU's Stu Johnson found an existing local example.
Angelica Foth-Goodwin and Maria Labrova are with Lepidext, working in biopesticides. They both attended the launch of Agriculture Technology Incentive Grants in Lexington. Their research focuses on controlling the corn earworm. Foth-Goodwin says it involves sterilization of the moth.
That contains a sterilizing virus. The virus is sexually transmitted, so we release the sterile moth containing the virus, then they mate in the field, transmit the virus to the insects that are already in the field, and then their offspring will be sterile, or most of their offspring will be sterile.
In addition to corn, the earworm eats tomatoes, soybeans, tobacco, cotton, and as Labrova says, whatever food is on their way, they'll have an appetite for. She admits the introduction of a virus does sound a bit daunting.
You say virus and everybody's like, whoa! You know, we've been through the pandemic, so everybody, when you say virus, it's like you're going to release a virus. Well, but this is a virus that it's contained only on the sexual organs of the species. So the rest of the moth is intact and perfect.
Labrova says the virus doesn't affect any other species, including humans. On the current timetable, the two researchers expect to have an Environmental Protection Agency review in about 18 months. If that goes well, it could be available technology in 2 years or so. I'm Stu Johnson.
The state's new medical cannabis law doesn't take effect for another year, but as we hear from Eastern Standard's Crystal Jones, efforts are underway now to tweak the new law.
It's a brand new year in the bluegrass, and on January 2nd, the Kentucky General Assembly had their first meeting. On the agenda was HB 72, a motion to make possession of a personal use quantity of cannabis exempt from civil or criminal penalty in Kentucky. The legalization of marijuana, a phrase that for many Americans evokes a scene of young people holding posters about freedom while quoting Ginsburg and Kerouac. The stigma was one of the most challenging to overcome for the cannabis users and supporters who find the controversial flower to be a medicinal source of relief for various physical and mental health issues. A quick note going forward, I'll be replacing the term marijuana in my vocabulary with cannabis.
Marijuana is a racist kind of term.
This bit of knowledge comes from Kristen Wilcox, the co-founder and president of Kentucky Moms for Medical Cannabis, which I thanked her for. And when researching this further, I found the topic covered in depth on an episode of NPR's Code Switch by Matt Thompson, who explains that pre-1900s, most printed accounts and notations of the flower used the term cannabis. A short time later, both the U.S. and Mexico began to regulate its use for political reasons. And in the U.S., the term marijuana was language that was intended to get the anti-immigration voters behind the Marijuana Tax Act. This detail is important because it exacerbates the extent of the struggle to be taken seriously for those who would use cannabis medicinally.
Medical cannabis users for years have got a bad rap, and there's kind of this stigma surrounding us.
Kristen's efforts to help change the public perception of cannabis users is a large part of what these Kentucky moms are doing.
We like to bring a different perspective to the table for legislators. We're moms and dads and grandparents who have children with debilitating conditions and no good options for treatment.
Kristen is one of those parents, and her approach has been one of patience and diplomacy.
We don't break laws. We changed them.
A marginal victory would come in the form of HB 47 last year, putting the possibility of medicinal cannabis on the table. The bill did pass, but the law won't be slated to take effect until 2025.
While we're very grateful for the governor doing his executive order, there's still a lot of issues with that. They have financial troubles that they can't drive out of state. They have mobility issues that prevent them from going. There's still the great possibility that there will be, you can still be arrested under the legal, under the executive order.
The purpose of the executive order from Governor Beshear does not prohibit anyone from being arrested under the current state laws. If you're found to be in possession of less than 8 ounces of cannabis for personal use currently, It is a misdemeanor in Kentucky. It's punishable by up to 45 days in jail and a $250 fine.
And going out of state is very expensive. You know, a lot of people are that we see have limited incomes. They're either elderly or disabled. It's because the federal level has not acted yet. These people are paying out of pocket for their own care.
Cost and access may be prohibitive, but Kristen says the most difficult obstacle to overcome at the moment is for those who feel cannabis is their best option for treatment, but whose diagnosis isn't currently on the list of accepted medical conditions.
Senate Bill 47 that we passed, it has a very short list of qualifying conditions. We need those qualifying conditions to be removed, even if they are extended or far more expansive than what was passed. There's still going to be somebody left out who needs this. My daughter is a great example. She has a very rare condition called Dravet syndrome. There is not a blanket term that they can put as a qualifying condition that will ensure that her and others like her are going to get access to this. I would suggest that we remove all the qualifying conditions and let doctors decide. Our legislators are not healthcare experts, and I don't think they have any business deciding on who should get access to this and who shouldn't.
Medical cannabis users, or those who would be, will continue to navigate the legal labyrinth surrounding the purchase and possession of cannabis until another executive order is passed or it becomes decriminalized, as proposed in the most recent assembly session.
Would make a huge difference for the most people. That's what we're going to continue pushing for.
To learn more about Kentucky Moms for Medical Cannabis, follow us at Eastern Standard on Facebook. To hear more stories like this one, subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform. For Eastern Standard, I'm Crystal Jones.
Governor Beshear is urging expansion of the medical marijuana program to include 15 additional medical conditions. The update would make the program available to an additional 437,000 Kentuckians. Is the United States drifting away from democracy and toward autocracy? Next in our series posing that question about the publicly stated intentions of former president and GOP frontrunner Donald Trump, Atlantic columnist and Naval War College professor emeritus Tom Nichols.
Every authoritarian regime begins with somebody saying, "How much damage can one guy do?" And then they find out. I think that's a normal human instinct, but I think we have to overcome it and we have to stop having failure of imagination about how bad this could be, because I think it could be very bad.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard Archive, our series, our partners, and more, and you can sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and anywhere you get podcasts. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.